we'll be discussing topics such as domestic violence and substance abuse.
This week we're going to look into Ivan Cantu and his retelling or his version of events, what he claims happened the days leading up to the murder up until his arrest. And so I think that's important to discuss Ivan Cantu and what we know of him. In talking to his family, it's come to light that he had a difficult childhood. It wasn't the easiest for him growing up. His parents were divorced at an early age, and his family believed that there was a lot of guilt surrounding that. And so there was a lot of, I think they gave him a lot more leeway simply because of that guilt. And because of that leeway, he became harder and harder to handle. And it was just this cycle. He was a handful. And there were times where his mother struggled with him, and she would ask his father to step in. And there were times where his father just felt like he was a kid and, you know, there was nothing that he could do. As he got older, I really don't know much about, you know, his teenage years up until his life around 1998-1999. But I do know that in 1998-1999, he was making a lot of money, at least for somebody his age at that time. We know that he was involved in some sort of scam, and we know that that was his excuse for putting the apartment that he was living in prior to his arrest in his girlfriend's name. He said that he had to put it in her name because he had to pretend to be poor for mortgage scams. We know that he was fired from his current job just a couple, like one day after the murder, the next day after it occurred, before anybody knew about any of it, he was fired. They don't give a reason. They just leave a message on his voicemail stating that his position was terminated immediately, and that if he had any questions, he could call HR. So we do know that he was committing fraud just to get people mortgages that in the end they wouldn't be able to afford. See, in 1998-1999, he was making great money. He had a very nice house. He had nice cars. He owned a Corvette, and he owned a boat, and, you know, they were living life. According to his friend Anthony Fonseca at the time, you know, he said he was living well beyond his means, and that he believes he may have taken out some loans that came back to bite him.
He was also married at that point, right?
Right. So he got married around the time when they, you know, they moved into this nice house. They had the nice cars. He was married for about 2 years. He met his wife through a friend.
But I mean, he had also not only, I mean, yeah, he was making $130,000 and had all this stuff, and but that $130,000 a year was also essentially based on mortgage scams, and he had already had several arrests. He'd been on probation for possession of a controlled substance, which I think was cocaine.
It was 0.7 grams of cocaine.
And that probation had been revoked because in the meantime, while on probation, not only had he missed appointments, and or he had also gotten a new DWI charge.
I didn't know it about this. I'm like, tell me more.
He had failed 2 drug tests for amphetamines and benzodiazepines, and he lied about having done drugs to his probation officer after he failed the drug test.
Benzodiazepines are medications like Xanax, Valium, that type of thing. And what was the other one?
Amphetamines.
Which speaks for itself.
So he was just doing all the drugs.
Basically.
Everything except opiates. GHB, benzos, speed, cocaine, ecstasy, mushrooms, and some occasional weed.
Right.
But then he was also in trouble for beating up on his wife at that point as well, right? Or had been?
Right. So he married this girl, Michelle. They were married for about 2 years. He met her. I think it was at a party or at a friend's house. And at the time, she was dating one of his friends. And he continued to pursue her despite knowing that. And I think he kissed her that night. And they eventually ended up together, married very shortly afterwards. and, you know, they bought the house, they had the nice cars, the money, all of that, which didn't last for very long. And, you know, he quickly lost all of it. His house was going in foreclosure, and his friend, Carlos Gonzalez, actually purchased the house in order to save it from going into foreclosure. But at this time, he was married to Michelle. Early on in their marriage, they were actually living with James and Amy, and there were a lot of issues of abuse at that time. I think there was one point where they were at a party, he was drinking, he started doing drugs, I think it was cocaine at this point, and he ended up becoming incredibly abusive towards her. He sexually assaulted her, he put her in a headlock, he put gum in her hair, I mean, he did all sorts of horrendous things to her, and she eventually left him. But it was at a time where, you know, he was losing his house, his cars, just everything that he was used to. And I believe he was living with a friend or his mother. I'm not sure which.
But so then he does what anyone would do in that situation. He joins the Navy. But he was only in the Navy for a very short time.
Yeah, it was
6, 7 weeks, something like that.
Something like that.
And he went AWOL. He went to go stay with his mother. She received a letter basically telling her, we're sorry to inform you that your son has gone AWOL. Please let us know if you have any contact with him. She chose not to do that. In his Navy file, his commanding officer actually wrote that Ivan Cantu is an administrative and disciplinary burden. His conduct represents significant departure from the conduct expected from members of the Naval Service. He has no potential for further naval service.
Sounds promising.
I know. I feel like we're just talking a bunch of shit because we're like, and, but this is where he was at.
Yeah, I believe one of the prosecutors in court had said he realized he couldn't manipulate his way through the Navy, and so he decided to leave.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how true that is, but that is what was stated in court, and the evidence seems to support it.
So he was staying with his mom.
He goes to work at the local strip joint. He took his job at Baby Dolls, which is also where Amy Betcher had been working at one point in time, along with his friend Carlos Gonzalez that he sold his house to. But at this job, I think he became a manager, but he was working there for several months. I think he was there for like 2 or 3 months. And that is where he met his wife, Jennifer. And he met her there, and they were married very quickly afterwards. I'm thinking less than a month it was.
Yeah, I think so.
They decided to go to Las Vegas. They were married, and I think they broke up within a couple of weeks. The marriage was annulled, and I think we found the marriage certificate, but it was the divorce that we were having a hard time finding. So Sylvia claims the marriage was annulled, but we didn't find any paperwork stating that, no divorce paperwork. And again, I really don't know how that works, but in court, it was brought up that they were still married during the time of trial. And whether anything was ever done about that, we don't know.
It had to have been within just a couple of weeks or so after that he then met Amy Betcher at Club 7, right?
Yeah, something like that.
I mean, it doesn't seem like he's able to be alone for very long.
Yeah, this is definitely a pattern.
So he's at Club 7. He meets Amy Betcher. He has, like, some smooth line where he's like, you're sitting at my table. And she's like, I don't see your name on it. And then they decided it was love. And they were almost together from pretty much that point on, except he met her August 17th, something like that.
She was at Club 7 with her friend Raina.
So he met her sometime on the 17th of August 2000. And I don't remember the date, but I know that it was that week, like within a few days, that he was actually committed to a psychiatric facility. He was staying with his mom still, like, and she had called the police because he was reportedly threatening self-harm. And I guess they took him in for, 24 to 36 hours?
It's typically a 2-hour hold. So after he spent some time in the mental hospital, he pulls this card, you know, he's pulled it at least twice. I mean, he said it again in the phone calls to his mom. Like,
yeah, but what did he say? Put a bag on his head?
Yeah. I don't know.
I guess options are limited.
Right. So once he gets done, I guess he's feeling so much better. Ivan and Amy decide to move in together. I believe they start off at a friend of theirs named, I think it was Chris Bobbitt. They both lived there for a while, and it was Ivan, Amy, and Amy's brother. There was no room there, so they moved in with Sylvia for about a week before getting kicked out. And it's really interesting that this time, Sylvia decides to come up with this crazy idea to try and get Ivan away from Amy. And she even calls Carlos Gonzalez to try and get him to help her with the scheme. She's telling Ivan that his dad had been kidnapped in Mexico and that Ivan was the only one that could save him. So she tries to get Carlos Gonzalez into this. I don't know why she couldn't just pick Amy out, but this is the way that she decides to solve that problem. Eventually,
she's not even on all the drugs that they are on at this point.
That we know of. So around the same time, Sylvia decides to take back the car that's in her name, which Ivan is driving, that he's making payments on. This leads to an altercation in a parking lot later on, maybe a week or two later, that was witnessed by James. He was asked to come there to keep things calm. And by somebody that worked for James named Rick Alcala, who also testified to that event in court. But it just seems that at this point, the drug use is really starting to spiral out of control.
They were doing a lot of meth, and I think it's like pretty much daily, right?
Yeah, it sounded like it to me.
Just the basic side effects from something like that are it impacts your impulse control, concentration, daily functioning, causes depression, anxiety, intense anger, sleep problems, which is kind of a given, but also psychosis and delusions. So this is the frame of mind that, you know, he's operating under.
Yeah, I'm not even sure how he was managing to hold a job, but I guess he really wasn't since he was fired on the 5th.
Yeah, and he worked at Super Salads.
That brings us to the story that Ivan concocts in order to explain away the entire situation, the murders, everything. He has the story about Domino's Pizza Man. So Ivan claims that he's at home after returning home from work at Countrywide, which we have no idea if that's true or not, but that's what he claims. So they have plans to go out to dinner with their friends that night. And between coming home and going out to dinner, this was Thursday, November 2nd, 2000, Ivan claims that Amy decides she's going to go pan, although it's not something that she normally does. And she just happened to come back 10 minutes later because they claimed it was closed. To me, this feels like, which I've noticed that both Ivan and Sylvia do, where they take a bit of truth and they kind of distort it to fit their narrative. So we do know that Ivan worked at tanning salons with James, at the ones James owed. And so I kind of feel like maybe he took this bit of fiction from that. I don't know. Anyway, she goes out to tan. There's a knock on the door. He looks out the peephole and he sees a Domino's pizza guy. So he opens the door to tell him he has the wrong apartment. The pizza man then pushes his way into the apartment, forces Ivan onto his knees, and puts a gun to his head. And at some point between doing this, threatening his life, and telling him why he's there, he introduces himself as Matt.
From the Valley.
Matt from the Valley, that's right. He puts a gun to Ivan's head, and he has a list of names, including James Mosqueda's sister and some of their family members, none of who were ever contacted by the pizza man or anyone else for that matter, and lets Ivan know that James owes a lot of money, so he is going to go down this list to threaten everybody until he gets paid. He asks if Ivan is working for James because James owes a lot of money to some drug dealers, and he wants to know when Ivan is going back to work with James in order to make money to pay back this debt. Ivan lets him know that he's not going to be working for James, and for some reason this really upsets the pizza guy, who then fires a shot over Ivan's head before leaving in a black Lincoln Town Car.
You're going to give us the visual of the pizza man?
So this is the best part. The pizza man was a mix between Steven Seagal and, what's his name?
John Travolta.
John Travolta from Pulp Fiction. And I like that he actually says from Pulp Fiction.
Yeah.
Because it feels like he's just watched that movie one too many times and is trying to make his life sound like something out of there.
I feel like there could have been a better name than Matt.
Sometimes I wonder. He was just looking around and was like, what is his name? He looked at his doormat and he was like, Matt. His name was Matt.
So that was November 2nd. And we have this timeline that has been provided to several different people by Ivan over what his version of events for the night of the murder. We're going to kind of go over this, but it's a lot of details. So November 3rd, from 8 to 5 p.m., Ivan says that he was working at Countrywide, and he actually visited the office in Plano, and he worked at home making some calls or processing loans through the internet. At 5:30, he gets home to change his clothes to go to his part-time job at Super Salad. He arrives there at 6. At 9:30, he finishes up his shift and heads home. And at 10 o'clock, he gets home from Super Salads. So this is the day after the pizza man. He tries to call James, but there's no answer. 10:05 to 11 o'clock, he showers and gets ready to go out for the evening. And from 10:05 to 11 p.m., I just do not see how it could take a man that long to get ready.
No.
That's like an hour. Anyway, 11:13.
He is pretty self-involved, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I did date one guy that not only took longer than me to get ready, but like actually had more product than I do, which is saying something. And I realized like I could never date somebody like that because he would have like real standards. Anyway, so 11:13 p.m. I just noticed it says 11:13.
Oh, well, yeah. What are you doing for those 3 minutes?
Right. He calls James, his cousin, and he agrees to visit with him at his house. So at 11:20 p.m., he arrives at James's house. And at 11:25, while still at James's house, he hears Amy, James's fiance, talking with her mother on the telephone, and they're discussing their plans for the next day.
And we know that that did happen because Amy's mother verified that.
And so that was basically the last contact that anyone had with Amy. I mean, any of her family or...
Right. Anyone aside from Ivan?
Right.
This starts at midnight. I'm guessing while he's still at James's house. So it says, James talks me into leaving a Honda Accord there and switching cars till the morning because he knew I was leaving town the next day. James wanted to portray that he was having company over because he owed someone a lot of money. I leave the Honda Accord spare key with James and Amy, and I leave in the Mercedes. When I left in the Mercedes, the Honda Accord was parked out front of the home. So this is where this game of musical cars starts.
So he's basically said that he's gone over to James specifically to tell him about the pizza man. And this is how James responds, by talking him into leaving the Honda Accord there.
Right. So James is fully aware, according to Ivan, James is fully aware that somebody is after him because he owes somebody a lot of money and asks him to leave his car there to make it look like they have company in order to, I don't know, keep anyone from coming over to kill him or to.
Which is strange because the pizza man has already exhibited that he has no fear of Ivan.
Right. Exactly.
So why that car being out there would be a deterrent, I really don't understand.
So 12:05 to 12:15, he takes a Mercedes. He goes to a nearby gas station and Albertson's grocery store because he needed to get cigarettes, gas, and gum. At 12:18, he goes back to get Amy at their apartment because they were going out for the evening. And he says that at this time, she's still getting ready. 12:50, they both leave the apartment, Ivan and Amy, and are going over to Kevin Partridge's apartment, who's also known as Smiley. And at this time, they're still driving the Mercedes. It says at 12:59 a.m., Tollway Records will confirm I'm traveling east on the tollway headed towards the residence of Kevin Partridge. And you and I have already mapped out all of the tollway hits, and we know that this tollway hit is legit. It actually happened. 1:15 a.m., my girlfriend and I get to Kevin's apartment. Kevin has several people over and has decided not to go out for the evening. Kevin is going to stay home and host a little get-together at his apartment. My girlfriend and I still want to go out, so we make the decision to leave. So at 1:35 a.m., Ivan and Amy leave Kevin's apartment and head to Club 7. 1:43 a.m., another tollway hit. They are traveling west on the tollway, still driving a Mercedes. At 2:30 a.m., I call Amy Kitchen on the cell phone. The cell phone I used is not the one mounted. The one I used, an extra cell phone James and Amy had, was left in the car. When I called, I wasn't wanting to specifically talk with Amy Kitchen. She just happened to answer the phone. I mentioned that one of the Mercedes tires is losing air, and since I am heading downtown, I can't drive this car, and I'm coming back to pick up the Honda Accord. Amy Kitchen said okay, and when I got to the house, pressed the garage door opener in the car, and she'll come out through the garage when she hears it raising. So at 2:35, they arrive at James and Amy's home. He pulls in and presses the garage door opener. Amy comes out through the garage. She pulls the Mercedes in. She returns the spare Honda key, and he leaves. Now, at this time, he says James is still in the house, and he only sees Amy Kitchen. At 2:37, they leave. It's very specific. They leave in the Honda Accord. 1 minute later, Amy Kitchen calls him back on the cell phone that he claims he accidentally took from the Mercedes. He says, "While previously driving the Mercedes, I accidentally put the cell phone in my jacket pocket. At this time, I'm not even towards the end of the street." Amy pleads with Ivan to come back and switch cars. James still wants to portray that they're having company through the evening, and they're asking Ivan to drive James's Corvette until the morning. I find it interesting here when Ivan says, "When Amy called me, I could hear James in the background telling her what to tell me. So at this time, I know they're both still alive." I turned around and head back towards James and Amy's house. I guess they're 1 minute later at 2:39.
Amy Kitchen comes out front of her house through the garage to meet me. I again leave the Honda Accord out front and give Amy the spare key to the Honda. At this time, I only visit with Amy Kitchen, and she mentions thanks for taking the Corvette and please bring it back in the morning.
I leave in the Corvette, and Amy Kitchen goes back into the house. Before heading to Club 7, my girlfriend wants to go back to our apartment because she wants to get some CDs to listen to. So he drives back to their apartment. They get there at 2:45 a.m. Amy goes inside for a while to get her CDs. He puts them in the CD changer that's in the rear hatchback area. And he says that while he's doing this, one of his neighbors says hello. Once the CDs are installed, then Ivan and Amy head back to Club 7. They leave at 2:55 a.m., and at 3:06 a.m., there are more tollway hits that will confirm that they're heading south on the tollway to Club 7. And the reason that they can tell the difference between these cars is because they each have their toll tags in order to take the easy tag lane without having to stop and pay with cash. So at 3:16, they get the toll hit at the end of the tollway. This is the last toll plaza they go to before getting to Club 7. At 3:20 a.m., they arrive at Club 7. They go inside to look for their friends. They say hello to a few people, and they say that the people that they were really looking for had already left, and so they stay for a while longer before leaving at 3:45 because Club 7 closes at 4. So in order to beat the crowd, they leave at 3:45, and they decide to head to a friend of Ivan's house who lives nearby. And at 4 a.m., Ivan and Amy arrive at Ivan's friend's house. This is Harlan Hill's house. At 3:45, Club 7 closes, so they decide to leave so they can beat the crowd. They decide to head over to Harlan's house close by.
At 4 a.m., Ivan and Amy arrive at Harlan's house.
So they decided to stay and hang out for a while. And at this time, they meet a guy named Fernando. Fernando mentions that one of his friends is having a party, so Ivan and Amy decide to go along with some other people to this party nearby. So at this time, and this is listed as unknown time, but it's between 4 and 6 a.m., they leave Harlan's house to follow Fernando.
How could he possibly know what time it is without the toll tags telling him?
At a second unknown time, they eventually reach Fernando's friend's house and join the party. They stay for a while, but since we know we're leaving for Arkansas soon, we leave shortly after. At 6 a.m., they leave Fernando's friend's house and head home. At 6:15, they have another hit on the toll road. They are entering from the South Plaza to travel north. They head back to James and Amy's house to pick up the Honda Accord and return the Corvette since they're traveling to Arkansas in the Honda.
Once we get closer to their home, I'll call so we can exchange cars. At 6:25, tollway records confirm they're heading north on the tollway. At this time, they're passing through the Beltline Toll Plaza. 6:28, the toll records confirm that they exit the tollway and head towards James and Amy's house to exchange the cars. At 6:30 a.m., I called James' house using their extra cell phone that I accidentally took that evening. When I called, I spoke with Amy, and I mentioned that I'll be there within minutes. During this conversation, I didn't hear James in the background like I did with the previous call at 2:38 a.m. I feel like he says this to kind of set a
like he's just throwing shade everywhere he can.
Well, I don't know. It just feels like he's trying to say, like, I know that he's probably dead at this point, and you might be able to tell, so I'm going to say, like, I can't hear him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. At 6:35 a.m., they get to James and Amy's house. He says that Amy Kitchens comes outside through the garage. She gives him back the spare key to the Honda, and he returns the Corvette by pulling it into the driveway. He says that she waves her to pull it into the garage. Again, he says he only deals with Amy Kitchens. So he and his girlfriend, Amy Betcher, leave in the Honda, and Amy Kitchen goes back inside. At 6:40 a.m., Ivan and Amy arrive back at their apartment in order to get some sleep before driving to Arkansas. Says once we get back to the apartment, I don't remember too much. All I really remember was walking in the front door. At 9:30 a.m., Ivan and Amy gather their things for their road trip to Arkansas, and they, you know, get dressed. They shower, they get dressed, and they start to head out the door. It says at 10:30 a.m., we leave for Arkansas. During the drive, I kept all my gas receipts to prove where I stopped and when, which sounds like something an innocent person would do. Plus, I save the receipts whenever we stop for food or snacks. At 11:15 a.m., while my girlfriend and I are driving to Arkansas, tollway records will confirm someone is driving James Moskva's Corvette on the tollway, and we are not sure who is driving it. At 8 p.m., they claim to have arrived at Amy's parents' house in Arkansas. Once they get to Arkansas, they primarily stayed in the house. However, we did leave a couple of times to visit her mother's workplace and visit a few grocery stores. And that's the timeline for Ivan Cantu. Is that all of it?
Yeah. What do you mean? That's a lot.
That's the timeline Ivan has created and given to police and to all of his followers in order to account for his whereabouts that night. This is...
Well, not to police.
Well, this is his side of the story. So we know that James and Amy were killed at some time between... 11:20 and I guess 6:30 a.m. You know, there's been some question on when they died based on differences in lividity or demarcation, whatever you want to look at. But there's just a lot of inconsistencies, things that don't add up, especially when looking at like the rigor of the bodies. But anyway, we'll get into that at another time. So it was Amy's mother who actually led EMS to James and Amy's house on Gibbons Street after not being able to get a hold of her for quite some time. Amy Kitchen and her mother were talking on the phone, as Ivan said, when he got there, and they had discussed their plans for the next day. So Amy had asked her mom to call her at 9 so that she could get a little bit of work done, and then they would go shopping at 9:30 and just hang out all day. So when her mother called her at 9, she didn't receive an answer. She calls back again at 9:30, 10. She keeps calling all day and is unable to reach anybody. They call their cell phones. They call their home phone. Her brother calls. Her father calls. And no one is able to reach them. So Amy's mom decides to drive the 30 minutes from Grand Prairie to where they live, and she gets no answer at the door. She's, you know, trying to look into the windows, can't see anything, doesn't get a hold of anybody, doesn't get a response. She goes to the fire department that's in the neighborhood and tells them what's going on. She lets them know she's very worried because this is unlike her daughter. So the fire department makes their way to the home and is able to get into the backyard. So once they get into the backyard, they're able to look into the windows. There's like a sliver between the windowsill and the blinds that they can see into, and they see
a pair of feet on the bed, and they're unresponsive. So they break a window, make their way in, and discover James and Amy shot to death in their home.
And somehow Sylvia ends up being one of the first people at the crime scene. And there are a couple of different versions of how she ended up there. One of them is that she received a phone call from one of James' coworkers, Ray Sanchez, or she says that he had seen it on the news and that he called her to tell her about it, and she immediately went over there. But it has also been said that she just had a feeling and decided to go by James's house. But while she's there, she decides that she's really concerned about Ivan because she hasn't been able to get in touch with him. And so even though she knew that he had been planning to go out of town, she decided to either, there's some debate about this too, she either asked some police officers to please accompany her to his apartment, or some police officers overheard her expressing her concern and wanted to accompany her to Ivan's apartment. But either way, two police officers, officers Iles and Younger, end up accompanying her to Ivan's apartment to do a welfare check to make sure that, you know, nothing's gone on over there.
Because when one person in your family dies, you automatically worry for another.
Right. There's nothing shady going on there at all.
Oh, yeah. So they make their way over to Ivan's house, which I think was a 2 to 7 minute drive. You know, it's incredibly close to, they're both straight off the tollway, and even without, it's faster not to get on the tollway than it is to take it. Anyway, they drive 2 to 7 minutes from James's house to Ivan's apartment. They're able to make their way in thanks to the help of, I think, some security officers and a manager that was still there before she left for the day. Sylvia was asked to stay in her car as they look around, and their testimony was that they were only looking in places where a body could be hidden. So, you know, they opened the closet doors, they looked under the bed, things like that. They're in there only to see if anybody is hurt. They're not there to look for evidence. They're there for about 10 minutes, and before they go back outside to call Sylvia inside. They allow her to come into the apartment so I guess she can have a look and see that everything's okay for herself. You know, it's at this time that one of the officers testifies that she stays by the kitchen. She is looking at her cell phone and at the telephone, at Ivan's telephone, his landline. And everything looks fine, so they decide to leave. The cops close up, Sylvia leaves, and a couple minutes later turns around while they're, you know, still, I guess, typing up the reports, and asks to check the caller ID before they leave. So they go back inside, and they wait by the door as she makes a phone call and checks the caller ID. And I think it's important to note here that this officer testifies to Sylvia Cantu making a phone call from the landline at Ivan Cantu's home. Once she's finished there, everybody leaves. And as they're leaving, they notice the bullet hole by the door that was left by Ivan's pizza man. At this point where they ask Sylvia if Ivan had a gun, yeah, she says not that she knows of.
In the meantime, Ivan's in Arkansas, and he checks his voicemail around 3 o'clock in the morning. He hears the news. He makes several phone calls. He calls Carlos's wife. He calls his mother, Sylvia. So he's aware of James's death. So in the meantime, Ivan's in Arkansas. He checks his voicemail around 3 o'clock in the morning, and he hears a message from his mother, Sylvia, informing him of James and Amy's death. And he makes a bunch of phone calls. He calls Carlos's wife. He calls his mother, Sylvia, obviously. He makes pretty constant phone calls throughout that entire night. But he didn't mention it. He didn't mention anything to Amy Betcher's parents until I guess they were asking throughout the day why he was on the phone so much. And he finally felt like he needed to offer an explanation since he obviously didn't actually plan on leaving to go back. And he just basically told Amy Betcher's stepfather that his cousin had been killed, but that he didn't really think very highly of him and didn't really want to be involved with any of that.
So during this time, while they're still in Arkansas, I think it was that Sunday, the detective Wynn, who's the lead detective on the case, manages to get a warrant, a search warrant for Ivan's house, or for Ivan's apartment. So they go back on Monday. They go back to Ivan's apartment on Monday in order to execute the search warrant, and they find 3 sets of keys, 2 of which contain, you know, keys to the Mercedes, or they contain the keys to the Mercedes, they contain keys to James and Amy's home. They find a box of bullets that are the same caliber as the murder weapon. They find bloody jeans and socks in the trash can as well. They even go back to, you know, a few weeks later to retrieve the bullet from the wall. And it turns out that the bullet in the wall that Ivan claims the pizza man left is actually a match to the murder weapon, as being fired from the murder weapon. Yeah, so the bullets that they retrieved from the wall turns out to have been shot from the murder weapon. And what else did they do?
What?
I think that's it, right?
Huh?
Is that all that they found there?
The jeans, socks. Bullet,
when I say bloody jeans and bloody socks, I'm not talking like soaked in blood. You know, there was blood spatter on them. It was obvious that they weren't what everybody is making them, you know, what Ivan and his associates are making them out to be.
And the way the jeans were in the trash can, like, you really wouldn't have even seen that, right?
Right.
Because the blood was at the bottom of the jeans.
Yeah, it was mostly around the cuffs. There was one swipe, you know, along the thigh, maybe near the knee, but it wasn't immediately noticeable. You'd have to look a lot closer.
So Ivan is on his way back to Dallas from Arkansas, Ivan and Amy Betcher, and he gets in touch with his ex-girlfriend, Tawny, who we will talk more about later. But they decide that they are afraid to go back to their apartment, so they want to go to Tawny's house instead, which I feel like if somebody called me and said, there's like a crazy pizza man running after me, my cousin was just killed, can I come to your house? I would be like, hell no. Get a hotel room.
Which is funny because that is what they were originally trying to do.
Right. So they go to Tawny's house, and when they get there, Ivan leaves, even though he's terrified, and goes, braves the journey to his apartment by himself, where he finds the inventory sheet that they left from the search warrant detailing the things that they took. So he goes back to Tawny's house, and they decide for some reason that they think that this inventory sheet is fake. So he calls his mom, and they decide to meet up at IHOP to discuss this.
So I think it's, like, what time is it when they all meet up at IHOP?
It's, like, the middle of the night. It's, like, 3 o'clock in the morning, I think.
That's right.
Because I remember thinking it was so strange that all these people are just awake all the time. Like, I can see them. They're on meth. But, like, his mother and his Aunt Penny.
Yeah, that is a little strange. Especially, but, I mean, I guess if it's important, and I guess you'll be there. Especially if it's covering up a murder.
Right.
Right. So they leave Tawny's house after arriving from Arkansas. They meet his mom and Aunt Penny before heading over to their friend Metal's house. They meet them at IHOP at 3 a.m. So I guess they decide to meet up to discuss the situation. They seem to be planning out the next step. In Sylvia's interview, she claims that Imee was acting just fine. You know, she could have run to the cops that were standing outside at any moment. But we know, based on her statements and her testimony, that Imee was terrified of both Sylvia and Penny. You know, there's talk of Penny having put a gun to Ivan's head in the past, that Sylvia carries a gun, and that there were other facts that she didn't elaborate on as to why she was so afraid of these two people. We know Ivan gave Sylvia a key to their apartment while at IHOP, although the reason is unclear since the warrant has already been executed, and anything of any evidentiary and anything of any evidentiary value has already been taken by police. So they discuss the warrant again, whether it's real or fake, because I believe his aunt Penny claims to have been studying law at some point.
Yeah.
Yeah, they arrive at the IHOP, and Ivan says, I thought we were being open with each other.
Yeah.
And this
was I think that was about the Carlos call, right?
I don't know. We know that Ivan stated, I thought we were being honest with each other. We don't know what that was in reference to. It was most likely regarding the well check, if he had to meet up with them in order to show them the warrant. Ivan tells his aunt that he's going to have somebody take care of Carlos, and that Imee knows everything and that he trusts her with his life. After they leave IHOP, they get gas, and again, his mother and Penny call Ivan. And Penny tells Ivan not to let Imee talk to any of her friends or family. And Sylvia states that she doesn't trust her. So after this meeting, they decide to head to their friend Metals in Irving, who
dealers.
Is actually one of their dealers. So once they leave the IHOP, you know, they head back to their dealer's house. And once after they leave their dealer's house, they head back to Tawny's. And I think they get there around 8 in the morning.
Yeah, and Tawny, and I should have mentioned that while Ivan was in Arkansas, he supposedly did speak with the detective. I don't know that we have evidence of that, do we? Do we know that for sure?
I'm not sure at what point in time he spoke with the detective, but I know the detective testified that Ivan was refusing to meet with them.
Right. So they go back to Tawny's, and Ivan has supposedly set up a time to meet with the detective. Tawny starts getting ready for work at like 9, right? They leave around 9?
Yeah.
But didn't they take a Xanax and try to get some rest?
Yeah, when they got back at 8, they took a Xanax.
Right. And so Ivan plans to meet up with the detective. He and Tawny supposedly leave at the same time.
I think we should say he plans to meet with the detective. I think we should.
But did he say that? Well, yeah, he had to have said that because that's how Tawny would have known that, right?
Yeah.
So he leaves sometime around 9 in the morning to go meet with the detective. He meets up with Sylvia first, and they go to an ATM. where one version of the story is that they were taking money out in order for Ivan to pay for an attorney.
Although they didn't think he was a suspect.
Right, yeah, I'm not sure why they would have needed attorney money. The other version, according to Sylvia, is that they were just getting some money out for barking.
Hundreds of dollars. Unless it was a $10 attorney.
Yeah, while Ivan is at the ATM, some cop cars pull up and they arrest him. So Ivan's arrested and they take him to speak to Detective Nguyen, who is handling the case. And based on the arrest report, Ivan starts off the conversation telling Detective Nguyen how he and his cousin grew up around narcotics pushers and that he personally never sold drugs, but he did use them. He says that he and James owned a painting salon together before James opened the mortgage company, and that one Thanksgiving day when they were growing up, his uncle took his life in front of them right before they sat down for Thanksgiving dinner.
And since this is the only time we're going to talk about that, I just want to say that ended up not being true. He did take his life, but it wasn't as it was described by Ivan.
It was kind of a random statement to make, really.
Detective, he was probably involved in selling drugs, but it's not how it was presented by Ivan, who makes it sound like it was inevitable that this was going to happen because it was a family business or something, you know?
Right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's just obviously a lead-in, too.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Detective Nguyen asks Ivan about... So Detective Nguyen is basically asking Ivan about what happened or what his story is. And Ivan tells him that he basically describes the story of the pizza man. He says that the pizza man told him that he had fronted James $300,000 worth of cocaine and that James had paid him $50,000 and still owes him $250,000.
Again, I don't have experience in narcotics. I've never sold drugs. But after speaking to people I know who have, and like reformed criminals, if you want to call them that, they're just saying how ridiculous the story is because nobody is going to ever loan anybody that amount of drugs on consignment. Not even $50,000. You know, the general consensus around the drug dealers in my life, around the drug dealers that I was in contact with was just that they would never allow anybody to take more than couple hundred bucks worth on consignment out of fear for them not being able to pay it back. So like
right.
The whole thing just sounds like he watched Pulp Fiction one too many times.
Well, yeah. It is so strange to me that when Sylvia calls Ivan multiple times in Arkansas, Dick Kramer doesn't detect any surprise or upset in Ivan's voice when he is supposedly told that James and Amy Kay are dead. This makes it look to me like Ivan already knew they were dead and was covering by calmly saying he had family problems. And Ivan says, no, at the time I found out, I did not know. So the podcaster PI had come up with some questions that he had submitted to Ivan, things that seemed a little strange. And Ivan responded to these questions. And one of the questions was essentially asking why it was that Amy's stepfather didn't detect any surprise or upset when Ivan was supposedly told that James and Amy were dead, because it almost makes it seem like he already knew that they were dead and was covering up for it by just calmly saying that he had family problems. Ivan's response to that was to say, quote, no, at the time I found out, I did not know. I'm a calm person. I wasn't hysterical. I wasn't freaking out. It was horrible news. I really am trying to figure out how to get out of this situation I'm in and get back home and deal with this or work this into a conversation with these normal country folks while I'm dealing with the craziest adventure. Which is an odd way to describe the brutal murders of your cousin and his fiancé.
Yeah, I'm just... Like, I'm at a complete loss of words for the way that he just described, you know, this trauma as a crazy adventure. It does seem like he has had 20 years on death row to go over all the statements and testimony and timelines and evidence against him and fit a story around it in order to make himself seem innocent.
I take issue with the fact that he says he's a calm person.
Yeah, especially since he liked to beat his wife.
I also take issue with the fact that he said those were normal country folks.
As opposed to the hills have eyes.
Next week on Question the Case.
You've heard Ivan's version of events. Next week, we'll be hearing from Amy Betcher, Ivan's girlfriend at the time of the murders, who went on to become the state's star witness. We'll be going over her very different version of what went down on the night of November 4th, 2000. Please join us then as we continue to question the case.
You will continue to listen and follow our journey as we unravel the case of Ivan Cantu and the He Said, She Said.
Please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts for updates and new episodes. Music by Shane Yoder at PutThemInASong.com. For case files and discussion, please join our Facebook group, Question the Case Podcast, or find us on QuestionTheCase.com.
See you all next time on Question the Case. Thank you.